Gathering is underway in Italy, where President Joe Biden and other world leaders are attending the G20 summit. It starts tomorrow. NPR's Sylvia Poggioli has a preview of the highly anticipated meeting in Rome.
This is the first time most of the leaders of the G20 countries that account for 75% of global trade and 60% of the world population, they're going to be meeting for the first time in person after nearly 2 years of lockdowns. Host Italy has set three action points, people, planet, prosperity, and hopes the summit will set a shared mid-century deadline for net zero gas emissions. The summit is an important preamble to the climate change conference next week in Glasgow.
NPR Sylvia Poggioli reporting. Biden met with Pope Francis at the Vatican one-on-one for 90 minutes, according to the White House, before the expanded meeting with other officials from the U.S. and the Vatican. The White House released a brief official readout of the meeting, which it says, in his audience with Pope Francis today, President Biden thanked His Holiness for his advocacy for the world's poor and those suffering from hunger, conflict, and persecution. Europol says it has disrupted a ring of cyber criminals operating in dozens of countries around the world. Terry Schultz reports the European Union Policy Agency says the group had been targeting critical infrastructure and large corporations with ransomware.
Europol says the dozen people arrested were, quote, wreaking havoc across the world with ransomware attacks against critical infrastructure. Europol describes the suspects' working methods. Some focused on accessing the IT networks, others in deploying malware. Sometimes they waited in compromised systems for months undetected, trying to gain further access before launching the attack and demanding payment in Bitcoin for targets to regain access to their own accounts. An international investigation team, as well as Dutch and U.S. independent investigations have been working to take down the ring since 2019. Europol says there are at least 1,800 victims in 17 countries. For NPR News, I'm Terry Schultz in Brussels.
The Chinese government is seeking to tighten its control over online information transmitted abroad. Today, the Cyberspace Administration of China announced a draft rule that would require companies with more than a million users to obtain government approval to transfer data overseas that may be deemed important to China's national security. International corporations have been worried about how Beijing's data security crackdown would affect their operations. One of the few Republicans in Congress who voted to impeach former President Donald Trump says he's not running for re-election. Illinois Representative Adam Kinzinger announced his decision on Twitter. He says he stands in awe of the courage of the nine other Republicans who voted to impeach Trump, knowing it could be detrimental to their careers. Kinzinger is on the Democratic-led House Select Committee that is investigating the pro-Trump January 6 insurrection at the U.S. Capitol. This is NPR News. Former New York Governor Andrew Cuomo was facing a misdemeanor complaint for forcible touching. Member station WNYC's Gwen Hogan reports.
The complaint from the Albany County Sheriff's Office alleges the former governor groped the breast of a woman in December of 2020 inside the executive mansion. Brittany Camiso, an executive assistant, made a formal complaint with the sheriff in August. But there was confusion as news of the sheriff's complaint broke. Sources later told the Times Union paperwork was filed prematurely and no final decision had been made about whether to formally charge Cuomo. The Albany County District Attorney said they too were surprised the complaint had been filed. Cuomo's lawyer seized on the confusion as further evidence allegations against him were politically motivated. For NPR News, I'm Gwen Hogan in New York.
For the first time in 6 years, Oklahoma has executed an inmate who was sent to death row for the 1998 murder of a prison cafeteria employee. Elizabeth Caldwell, member station KWGS, reports that minutes before receiving the first of three lethal injections yesterday, John Marion Grant convulsed and vomited after being given a sedative.
Grant was part of a lawsuit challenging Oklahoma's lethal injection procedures. The state botched an execution in 2014 and another in 2015. Officials reportedly used the same drugs, though the Department of Corrections refuses to release records on the cocktail. A trial over the drugs is set for February 2022, but in the meantime, six more people are scheduled to be executed in Oklahoma. For NPR News, I'm Elizabeth Caldwell in Tulsa.
The Dow is up 47 points. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Charles Schwab, with a variety of financial planning options from online tools to meeting with a financial consultant. Schwab works to make it easy to plan for tomorrow, today. More at schwab.com/plan.
Welome to the Florida Roundup. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville. My co-host Tom Hudson is off this week. Well, Governor Ron DeSantis's pick to be the state's next Surgeon General has been embroiled in controversy ever since he was announced. Dr. Joseph Latipo has spoken out against mass mandates and vaccine requirements, and that has raised concerns in Florida's medical community. But this week, Latipo came under even hotter fire for refusing to wear a mask in the office of a state senator battling breast cancer. Several Democrats and some newspaper editorial boards are calling for Dr. Latipo's resignation, but Governor DeSantis is sticking by his pick.
He actually explained, you know, he offered numerous accommodations, and it was more, I think, about an issue. There's pictures very close with no mask in other instances. I mean, I don't see Michael people talking about that. So I think this was more, they're trying to politicize this.
Now, earlier this week, Democratic State Senator Tina Polsky, representing parts of Palm Beach and Broward counties, accused Dr. Latipo of refusing a request to wear a mask in her office. Latipo says he offered to accommodate her by talking outside. She didn't want to do that. Pictures from earlier in the day did show Polsky alongside some other maskless senators in a committee hearing. We begin the closer hour here on the Florida Roundup with a look at Dr. Latipo's nomination for Surgeon General and his stance on masks. 305-995-1800. Let us know, Florida, should Dr. Latipo be confirmed as Florida Surgeon General? Tweet us at Florida Roundup. We're already getting your tweets. Christine Sexton has been covering this story. She's a reporter with Florida Politics and joins us now. Good to have you, Christine.
Hi, thank you for having me.
We also welcome Dr. Bernard Ashby, a vascular cardiologist and Florida director for the Committee to Protect Healthcare. Dr. Ashby, good to have you back on the show as well, sir.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
305-995-1800. We'll go to your calls in a moment. Christine Sexton, let's start with you. Tell us what you learned about the encounter between Dr. Latipo and Senator Polsky and the subsequent fallout.
Well, what I learned is that as both sides agreed to what happened, you know, the senator, Dr. Latipo, had called the senator, requested to meet with her because as a nominee, he requires Senate confirmation. So he, you know, wanted to meet with her. He came into her office. There are signs that say, please wear a mask. And he wasn't wearing one either. His two assistants weren't wearing one either. And the senator told me that she did not disclose to him that she had stage one breast cancer, but, you know, repeatedly said, I have a serious medical condition. And, you know, he just kept offering her alternatives, which made her uneasy because he was in her office talking without a mask, you know. Which is what she was just trying to avoid. And both sides say the same thing. And when she asked him to leave, he left. But, you know, allegedly there were some remarks made about trying to have conversations with unreasonable people. Hmm. And I think that's what the Senate president didn't like.
Right. Senate President Wilton Simpson has publicly rebuked Dr. Latipo over this, saying he should have shown better manners. Dr. Latipo has tried to explain this by saying he didn't feel he could communicate well with a mask on. Governor DeSantis is standing by his pick for Surgeon General. Do you still think he'll be officially confirmed?
Well, when I saw the Senate president in Orlando 2 days ago, and I asked him that, I said, you know, can you tell me, do you think your chamber will confirm him? And what are you feeling about now? And he didn't comment on the confirmation, but that's when he did, you know, he doubled down on his remarks and said, you know, he should have some manners. And I know that the governor thinks that this is being politicized, but Senate President Simpson is a Republican. Senate President Simpson has stood behind the governor and his COVID policies. So this is a Republican who is standing, you know, Polsky is a Democrat and he is standing behind, you know, one of his members. So I'm not sure Simpson, you know, saying that the doctors should be respectful and confirming Senator Polsky's right to ask him to leave. I don't see Simpson's moves as being political, which is what the governor claims. I mean, like I said, he's a Republican.
I guess we'll have to see how the confirmation vote goes. Let's bring Dr. Bernard Ashby into the conversation now. He directs a committee to protect health care in Florida. Dr. Ashby, you and doctors across the state have loudly objected to Dr. Latipo's confirmation as Surgeon General. Can you share more of what you and your colleagues are saying about this?
Well, again, thanks for having me, and it's a wonderful pleasure to be here. So Dr. Latipo, as you know, has a great background. I mean, he's, you know, highly trained, and he is fresh off of being a professor at UCLA and a researcher. And, you know, if you look, simply looked at his background, you would think that he would be a proponent of evidence-based measures, specifically those measures that have been shown to decrease infection and death in regards to the COVID-19 pandemic. Yet he has shown a pattern of aligning himself with those with political agendas, specifically the America's frontline doctors, which have advocated for things like, you know, herd immunity through spread of the infection, which they call natural immunity, and also their promotion of ivermectin and hydrochloroquine, which have been shown not to have efficacy in patients with COVID-19 disease. But beyond that, he has now aligned himself with Governor DeSantis, who basically has thumbed his nose at evidence-based medicine and public health measures that have been shown to be effective, and has basically taken a political and oppositional stance to anything related to really bringing this pandemic under control. And so we feel that he is basically using his credentials and his, perspective as a physician to provide cover for Governor DeSantis and his reckless take on this entire pandemic. And we're just patently against it. And, we're just tired of politics and we just want to focus on the public health issues.
Zach tweets the show at Florida Roundup. I question why someone from California was brought to Florida to be our Surgeon General instead of a Florida doctor. Is that what you're getting at, Dr. Ashby, that Dr. Latipo, some perceive, has been imported here in accordance with the governor's political agenda rather than with public health top of mind?
Yeah. People forgot that the previous Surgeon General, Scott Rivkees, was actually pulled from a press conference when he discussed the importance of wearing a mask until vaccinations were rolled out. And you know, we basically didn't hear from him again. What Governor DeSantis did was handpick someone that's not even from Florida, knows nothing about the social, cultural, healthcare dynamics here, to essentially serve as his mouthpiece in the public health sector. And so rather than using the office of the Surgeon General as a reference for expertise, Governor DeSantis is essentially feeding him his talking points and his perspectives, and he's just echoing it. He has not basically indicated anything that was unique and differentiates himself from Governor DeSantis. In fact, what's particularly preposterous is that he hasn't disclosed whether or not he's been vaccinated. Dr. Latipo hasn't. I mean, how can you be the Surgeon General and not disclose whether or not you've been vaccinated? I mean, you can't be any more reckless than that. I mean, that, you know, we all know that vaccines have greatly mitigated the impact of the pandemic in terms of death rates and hospitalizations, and yet he's essentially made vaccines, you know, just one thing that we use for the pandemic instead of, you know, calling it what it is, our really our most effective tool.
And
again, and he's not even disclosing whether or not he's been vaccinated. That's just irresponsible.
And certainly masks are commonly used in surgery, for example. Doctors communicate perfectly fine with nurses and other doctors in the operating room when they're masked up and in other contexts. Okay, we're talking about the nomination of Dr. Joseph Latipo to be Florida's Surgeon General. He has yet to be officially confirmed. He is under fire this week for refusing to wear a mask around a state senator with breast cancer, even after she asked him to. As we talk about this, we want your calls, Florida, 305-995-1800. Dr. Neil Levine calling from Fort Lauderdale. Dr. Levine, go ahead, sir.
Good morning. Well, to second Dr. Ash's comments in spades, the issue is beyond just the mask issue. We already know that the Delta variant can infect people who have very few signs and symptoms, which means if one is infected but not terribly symptomatic and unmasked, that you can, in fact, spread the virus to other people who you may not know have or have not had the vaccine. So it's a simple public health issue that people at large should simply mask. It's not a difficult concept. The whole idea, and I grant Dr. Latipo on paper appears to be highly trained, highly educated, et cetera. However, his stance appears to be ignorant at best. Beyond that, I don't think there should be any doubt that a governor who has such wanton disregard of public education and children and wanton disregard of the best science that this country can present to the world should have anything other than a political agenda. We have an outstanding COVID researcher and expert in Dr. Aileen Marty at FIU.
And she's appeared on this program. Yeah.
Yeah. It would have taken 2 minutes for the Dove to pick up the phone down there and say, hey, can I put you up here as Surgeon General? And she's certainly a lot closer to Tallahassee than where Dr. Latipo is coming from. The idea that this is anything other than political is ludicrous.
Okay, Dr. Levine. Christine Sexton, Florida Politics. Certainly the governor has come under intense criticism around this matter in particular, but his pandemic response more broadly. And so talk about this in the context of the governor's political ambitions.
Oh, well, you know, I mean, clearly the governor, this has become such a political debate. Everyone understands it's a public health issue, but I feel as though this is almost a ticket to get you noticed if you take controversial positions and if you buck, the Biden administration and the vaccine mandates and what the president's trying to do. I mean, clearly the governor has ambitions beyond just being the governor of the state of Florida. And this is getting him national attention. His choice of Dr. Latipo, even prior to what has occurred with Senator Polsky, I mean, that pick, he was a lightning rod. And the minute DeSantis, picked him, people focused on it. So, I think, clearly he is drawing his line in the sand and he is going to be the governor that fights vaccine mandates, that fights mask mandates, that fights lockdowns. And this is his calling card, I feel. And he's going to have a state surgeon general that believes in his policies. And quite candidly, this isn't the first COVID. This is, obviously about COVID, but this isn't the first time that the governor has, has done something contrary to public health. I mean, after getting elected, the governor forced the legislature to, allow people to smoke marijuana, which the constitutional amendment allowed.
Yeah.
He made a board of medicine, a group of doctors, pass rules saying, smoking pot is good for you. It's medicinal. And that board of medicine, they didn't want to do that. And Dr. Scott Rivkes was a doctor that was willing to back the governor up on smoking pot is good for you. It's, no doctor in their right mind thinks smoking is good for your lung. It's not good for you.
Sure. Yeah. Thanks for that example. If I may, let me get a few more calls on the air. Dr. John Reese, lots of doctors calling in today. Dr. John Reese in Sarasota, Florida. Dr. Reese, go ahead.
Hello. I just wanted to point out that Dr. David Nelson, who's the president of University of Florida Health, where Dr. Latipo is a professor of medicine. He was made professor of medicine at the same time he was appointed by Dr. DeSantis, because University of Florida is the state university. Dr. Nelson has passed a vaccine mandate. He states, his letter says, UF Health plans to comply with President Biden's recent executive order requiring employees of certain contractors that do business to be fully vaccinated. And he states that all employees and all staff members of the University of Florida, regardless of where they practice or what their mode of practice is, whether it's patient-based or administrative, are required to be vaccinated. So Dr. Latipo, if he's not already vaccinated, he will be required to be vaccinated to keep his job and his position, and he will also be required to document that, and that will be a point of public record. So I'm interested
okay.
to see how this plays out.
How this plays out, yeah.
Dr. Latipo reacts.
Thank you, Dr. Reese. Okay, Dr. Bernard Ashby, the UF Board of Trustees chair, we learned this week, who is a Republican mega donor advisor to the governor, worked to fast track Dr. Latipo's resume at UF. And so the governor's hiring at UF was fast tracked through political channels, even as members of the UF faculty have spoken out against his stance on vaccines and masks. What about that, Dr. Ashby?
Well, this is business as usual for DeSantis. Uh-huh. Essentially, he has used this pandemic as an entire platform for him to prime himself for his presidency run, and also to basically take care of his close connections and his donors. And this relationship, this back and forth relationship, we've seen time and time again, and it's actually influenced his policies. So, his stance on keeping Florida open, that was a clear appeal to many of his large donors who depended on Florida tourism. And beyond that, he's actually, prioritized his donors during the initial onset of the vaccination distribution campaign. And now with Regeneron and his ties there, DeSantis has basically, used the pandemic to increase the wealth and his influence. And now you see his connection there at UF, who was able to fast track and get Dr. Latipo professorship at UF.
And so, and we
this
will.
Is, this is completely consistent with him.
Thank you, Dr. Bernard Ashby, Christine Sexton of Florida Politics. Thank you both. When we come back, why your electric bills are going up this winter. Next on the Florida Roundup from Florida Public Radio. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup. Thanks for listening and supporting public radio in Florida. I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville. My co-host Tom Hudson is out this week. Well, you're not going to like this news. Millions of you out there can soon expect higher utility bills. Yeah, earlier this week, state utility regulators approved a series of base rate increases for Florida Power and Light. It will result in higher monthly bills for FPL customers starting in January. In fact, your bills are expected to go up about 20% over the next several years. Now, despite arguments that residential and small business customers will end up subsidizing the costs for larger customers, Florida's Public Service Commission unanimously supported this four-year rate settlement. It calls for a $692 million increase in base rates starting in January. An additional increase of $560 million is planned for 2023, and you can expect more increases in the following years to pay for solar projects. Meanwhile, JEA customers here in Jacksonville, where I sit, will also see their bills go up starting in December. That's due to rising natural gas prices. Now, all of this is happening even as it's still tough for the average Florida resident who wants to tap into alternative power sources like solar panels to get access to them. So let's get into this. Brendan Rivers is the lead reporter for ADAPT, a digital magazine produced by WJCT Public Media, covering the impact of climate change on Florida. Hi, Brendan.
Hi, Melissa. Thanks for having me.
Good to have you. Also with us, Alyssa Schaefer, research associate with the Energy and Policy Institute. Hey, Alyssa.
Hello. Thank you so much for having us on.
Look forward to talking to both of you. In Florida, give us a call. Your electric bills are going up by quite a bit over the next few years. We're going to get into the reasons why. Let us know your thoughts. 305-995-1800. Tweet us at Florida Roundup. Well, Alyssa, why did these rate hikes go through despite the strong opposition? Let's explain that.
That's a really important question. And I think to understand why something like a $1.5 billion rate hike just gets rubber stamped with really only a few minutes and hardly any in-depth discussion that happened when this got approved. The reason that such a huge thing just gets that quick rubber stamp of approval really comes down to what has been decades of work from the utilities into capturing the regulatory environment. And when we say the regulatory environment, we're talking about the Public Service Commission. They're the ones that just voted to approve this rate hike. We're also talking about the Office of Public Counsel, and we're also talking about the Florida Legislature. Those three bodies together, really over the last several years, have come under control of the investor-owned utilities, and that's been through series of millions of dollars of political donations, heavy investment in lobbying, and at the end of the day, it gets us to where we are here, where we see this $1.5 billion rate hike, again, hitting the residential customers the hardest. And not only is it including solar investments, you mentioned that, I want to clarify, it also is including new fossil fuel infrastructure. And it is a subsidy to those corporate customers as well.
Thank you for that. We need to note that this is all happening as today marks a movement around the globe called 24 Hours of Climate Reality, a global day of action on climate. At the same time, a UN climate conference is coming up next week in Glasgow. It's billed as humanity's last best hope to stave off the worst impacts of climate change. And yet here in Florida, we see, as Alyssa points out, the major investor-owned utilities capturing the regulatory environment, essentially controlling the regulators. And Brendan Rivers of ADAPT Florida, the average Florida resident doesn't want to pay higher bills, and they want to see more of a turn toward alternative and renewable energy sources. But it's hard for the average Florida resident to even access alternative sources. Can you explain why the environment is so difficult in Florida and why the legislature, as you report, along with the utilities, has played a role in all of this?
Yeah, so utilities throughout Florida have kind of been moving away from coal and oil, which are the main contributors to the fossil fuel emissions that are really driving climate change. But to get away from those energy sources, they've really relied on natural gas. And this has kind of become a personal project of mine, because a lot of people don't realize the natural gas is itself a fossil fuel. Burning it to produce energy produces carbon dioxide, which is the main greenhouse gas that's driving climate change. On top of that, the process of extracting and transporting natural gas results in methane being emitted into the air. And methane is far more potent than carbon dioxide as a greenhouse gas. So natural gas is a problem here. Florida has ramped up its reliance on solar. It is actually right now the Florida leads all of the Southeast region in terms of solar energy. I don't know how much that's saying. I think.
Yeah, that's not saying much.
Yeah, the Southeast, I think, is behind the rest of the country. But solar, utility scale solar is ramping up, and a lot of utilities have made commitments to invest in that. Wind and hydroelectric power are still pretty much non-existent here. Nuclear isn't really much of a factor, though, as Jacksonville listeners will know, JEA is investing in some nuclear power that hopefully will come online in the next few years, but it keeps getting delayed. And then when it comes to rooftop solar, so that's sort of the option that customers have to kind of produce their own renewable energy, is becoming more challenging because utilities are kind of pushing against this policy that's known as net metering. And what net metering is basically what utilities credit to their customers who produce excess energy with their rooftop solar panels. And JEA, Jacksonville city-owned utility, kind of led the way with this push when they got rid of their net metering policy a few years back. And a lawsuit basically just got thrown out recently that was challenging that decision. So it looks like JEA's current net metering policy is going to stay. And we're seeing a lot of chatter from the state's bigger investor-owned utilities that they kind of want to move in that direction as well. And basically what that does is it makes it take a lot longer to recoup that investment that people have to make to install the rooftop solar. So what I heard was here in Jacksonville, under JEA's original net metering policy, which credited rooftop solar customers with exactly the amount that they would pay to buy energy. So originally it would take about 7 to 9 years to recoup that investment on rooftop solar. Mm-hmm. And then once the net metering rate was reduced, which from about 10 cents to 3 cents per kilowatt hour, that time to recoup jumped to about 20 years. So it's a much more difficult investment to make right now.
That's a much bigger hurdle to climb for people. So Alyssa Schaefer, let's talk about this in the way that most people will experience it. Higher bills for their FPL or whatever utility they have. Can you talk about these rate hikes related to solar power? Are customers being asked to basically subsidize FPL solar expansion? Tell us more about this.
I think to characterize this as a subsidy is an interesting way to frame it. It's definitely, ratepayers are being asked to subsidize sky-high profits for the investor-owned utility. Part of this, they had a 10.6% return on investment that was a return on equity that was approved. And that is basically how much profit they're authorized to make on their investments. So when you have utility scale solar baked into something like that, you're not building in any type of competitive mechanism to make sure that customers are getting the lowest cost possible. At the end of the day, Florida Power and Light is an investor-owned utility, and they are motivated by profit. And they also are motivated to continue riding the gravy train that they currently have, which Brendan mentioned being fossil fuel gas, often referred to as natural gas. Even with these planned investments in utility scale solar, if you look at their regulatory filings, you know, their projections, Florida Power and Light's projections for the year 2030, they're still at about 60% reliant on fossil fuel goals or on fossil fuel in terms of their energy mix. And their peers in the state, Duke, you have them at 75% reliant on fossil fuel gas. TECO, they're close to 80% reliant on fossil fuel gas. So these solar installations that they're baking into the rate base, on the one hand, yes, we need to see transition to this clean energy. On the other hand, it needs to be competitive. We can't just be giving subsidies to large corporations and leaving residential customers to foot the bill while those same customers are also footing the bill for increased investment in fossil fuel infrastructures. I think it's also important to note that Florida Power and Light has no commitment to absolute carbon emissions reductions. Their parent company, NextEra Energy, is the only investor-owned utility that has yet to make even a perfunctory goal when it comes to absolute carbon emissions. Like most of these companies, even if there's problems with it and we're not quite sure how sincere they are, they're making commitments like net zero by 2050. They're trying to get in line with the Biden administration goal of decarbonization by 2035. But NextEra is not doing that. And in the process of this rate case, CEO Eric Szilagyi, in a deposition, actually doubled down on the fact that Florida and Power Light has no goal to reduce carbon emissions in a concrete way, and even took a step away from the more word game type goals that NextEra plays. NextEra will say stuff like, we want to reduce the intensity or we want to reduce the rate of emissions, but they won't commit to a concrete reductions in terms of like metric tons, which would be the standard for the industry. And that goes back to the fact that they have a lot of investments in fossil fuel infrastructure. Some of it is here in Florida with NextEra and with their other sister company, Florida City Gas, and some of it is spread out throughout the country. So when you have a company that is making hand over fist profit on fossil fuel infrastructure, of course they're not going to make a concrete goal to reduce that. But for Floridians, that means that A, we're stuck with the impact that that is having on climate change and will continue to have on climate change. And we're also stuck with the bill.
We're also stuck with the bill. 305-995-1800. As we talk about higher utility bills, you can expect across much of Florida. You're listening to the Florida Roundup from Florida Public Radio. Here's a tweet from a listener. Our utility bill has already gone up substantially over the past 2 months, despite our usage being down from last year, he says. So Brendan Rivers with ADAPT, you've reported at adaptflorida.org that back in January, the city of Tampa was set to become the 12th city in Florida set to set a climate goal to transition to 100% clean energy. Then the natural gas industry and the legislature got involved and put the kibosh on that. So even people in Florida who are trying to do the right thing, they face a built environment, let's say, in Florida that makes it very difficult. Can you talk a little more about that?
Yeah, I mean, as far as I know, there are no statewide policies that would result in lower fossil fuel emissions. And that's kind of left things up to local governments. And as you mentioned, in Tampa, there was a city councilman there that introduced this non-binding resolution. So it was just kind of like a symbolic bill, basically, with no real teeth, that basically said that the city would ban new fossil fuel infrastructure like pipelines and power plants and stuff like that. And then there was this pretty swift response from lawmakers, from one in our area specifically, Travis Hudson, down in St. Augustine. And he introduced a couple of bills that Governor Ron DeSantis signed this summer that basically prohibit local governments from taking any action that restricts or prohibits energy sources used by utilities. And it also avoids any existing local policies to that effect, except for in cities that own their own utilities, like Jacksonville, Orlando, and Tallahassee. And then the bills also prevent local officials from banning gas stations or requiring gas stations to install electric vehicle chargers. So it's there's a lot of research out there that basically shows that elected officials are not great when it comes to getting behind efforts to mitigate a problem. They're happy to support efforts to help people and communities recover. But when it comes to efforts to mitigate, like reducing emissions that are causing climate change, that there's a lot of resistance. And I think we kind of see the same thing happening with other issues as well in Florida. I mean, when you talk about the coronavirus pandemic, I mean, they're trying to stop people from local governments from enacting mask mandates and stuff like that too. So this is kind of becoming a trend in Florida politics, where Tallahassee kind of isn't really into home rule anymore, which kind of used to be the
standard,
the mode of operation in the past. Yeah.
George in Davenport. Hi, George. Go ahead. You're on the radio.
Oh, yeah. Well, the underlying problem with the solar and all these other things are that Floridians, we don't really care where we get our electricity from. just like we don't care where we get our water from, we don't care where what happens to our recycled products, I mean plastic products, we just don't care. And if you have the majority of the population doesn't care, nothing's going to get resolved. We're not going to pass laws that enforce it to make us change our behaviors.
Well, hey, George, so that, you know what? That's why we're doing the segment, so people can learn and maybe care. So let's close with Alyssa Schaefer. Alyssa, as I mentioned, 24 Hours of Climate Reality is a movement happening around the world right now as we speak. The climate conference is coming up next week in Glasgow with an urgent call to reduce emissions. In the short time we have left, how can people learn more about this issue, would you say, in Florida and beyond?
I would say for folks that are motivated to learn more, because I think a lot of people do actually care about this, listening to programming like this is a great place to start. So I appreciate you having this conversation. Reading stuff from reporters such as Brendan Rivers, checking out the Invading Seas Collaborative. There are a lot of reporters and researchers who are really digging into this. You're also welcome to check out my organization that I work with folks all over the country tracking what utilities are up to. That's Energy and Policy Institute. But in a really concrete sense, it's so critical to pay attention to what is happening with your local utility company and your elected officials. For a lot of people, we have that FPL bill set on auto pay. We hope there's enough money in the account for it to go through, and
right.
We try not to think about it because it's just that monthly withdrawal.
Yes.
Most people don't even know how many kilowatt hours they're using.
So pay,
take a look at that.
Look at your bill. Look at the bill and contact your representatives and let them know your
thoughts.
Thank you, Alyssa Schaefer, with the Energy and Policy Institute, Brendan Rivers of ADAPT Florida. Thank you both. And when we come back, Disney World marks 50 years of magic in Central Florida and plans ahead too. Next on the Florida Roundup. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville. Tom Hudson is out this week. Well, all this month, Walt Disney World has been celebrating its 50th anniversary in Orlando. Disney World, the largest theme park in the world, welcomed its very first guests on October 1st, 1971. Over the next five decades, the park, which covers more than 40 square miles in Central Florida, grew into an entertainment complex that includes four theme parks, two water parks, golf courses, a shopping destination, and 27 resort hotels. Now, days of festivities kicked off Disney's big half-century milestone, but they've got a lot more planned over the next 18 months. Visitors to the parks can also expect plenty of new attractions and improvements. With more on Disney's big 50th golden anniversary and how theme parks are working to recover attendance after the pandemic, we welcome Seth Kuberski, a reporter at Orlando Weekly, co-author of the Unofficial Guide series, and he also writes for Attractions Magazine. Hi, Seth.
Thanks so much for having me.
Good to have you. 305-995-1800 as we talk about Disney. So what's new at Disney as they mark this big 50-year anniversary?
Well, they kicked off on October 1st by introducing a couple of new additions that have been long awaited as guests waited through the pandemic for anything new at the Disney parks. The big one is the new Remy's Ratatouille attraction at Epcot. That's an expansion to the France Pavilion. That's actually a clone of a ride that opened almost a decade ago in Paris. And then in addition to that, Epcot has a new fireworks show called Harmonious that replaces the long-running fan favorite Illuminations, and a new fireworks show at the Magic Kingdom called Enchanted.
So a lot.
Those are three biggest.
Those are the big attractions
launched already.
Okay, and they're planning 18 months of celebration, aren't they? And also, they've changed the way you can access the park. Tell us about the rollout of Disney Genie and Genie Plus and what that means for people wanting to come to Orlando and visit the parks.
Yeah, so since the pandemic, Disney introduced a park reservation system that requires people to pick in advance which park they're going on any given day, including annual pass holders who are used to just wandering in at any time. And now with their new service, Disney Genie, which also includes Disney Genie Plus and something called Lightning Lanes, they've added a whole new layer of complexity. People in the past might remember the Fast Pass system, which was a free system that let you schedule a time to skip three rides in the park each day. And now Genie and Genie Plus offers a similar system, but for a fee. Folks are now going to be expected to pay $15 a day on top of their regular admission in order to access this system and let them skip some of the lines for the more popular rides. The real controversial thing, the one that's kind of set off a lot of alarm bells along longtime Disney fans, is the addition of individual lightning lanes on a few of the real top attractions, such as the Star Wars Rise of the Resistance ride, which typically gets hour-long waits or more. Now you can buy your way past the line at specific rides for anywheres from $7 to $15 a pop. And that for a lot of people kind of flies in the face of the tradition that everyone seemed to be equal at Disney.
Interesting. Well, you know, that brings up a bigger point. Tell me a little bit more about how Disney World plans to recover attendance coming out of the pandemic. Certainly when the pandemic hit, it laid bare some of the fault lines in the states and particularly Orlando's tourist-based service economy and the low-wage workers that power that economy.
Yeah, the theme park industry, along with all forms of hospitality, restaurants and hotels, were, you know, hit very, very hard in the pandemic. And Walt Disney World laid off a good portion of their staff. And while they say that they're planning to come back to almost full staffing by the end of this year, there's still a lot of folks, especially I want to point out in live entertainment, union equity actors, who have still not gotten back to work after all this time. You know, Disney has taken the reopening as an opportunity to see where they can tighten the belt and cut costs while at the still same time, you know, increasing prices and, you know, to try to push and see where that market, where that line lies. It's to the point of trams that take folks from the parking lot where they've paid almost $30 a day to park their car. They still don't have a tram to take them to the front of the park. Originally, those were eliminated because of COVID and social distancing concerns, but social distancing has been dropped throughout Walt Disney World. And now, you know, we kind of see the things that they feel that they can hold back on returning as long as possible until they see attendance meets it. Now, the good news is, while there was a unexpectedly slow September and October got off to a little bit of a slow start, by the end of this month, we are seeing a definite resurgence in attendance. Universal just announced that they've had their most profitable quarter ever, and I wouldn't be surprised to see similar results when Disney releases their quarterly results at the beginning of next month.
You're listening to the Florida Roundup from Florida Public Radio. So that's interesting, Seth. Both Disney and Universal think people are really primed to put the pandemic years behind them and get back to these parks.
I think they are really looking forward, especially to the international borders reopening in early November. A lot of Orlando's tourist economy relies on British tourists and Brazilian tourists who typically come for a longer period of time and spend more per person than the average American visitor. And I think once that the pent up demand from those markets is able to be relieved when the borders open, I think that we could look forward to a holiday season that rivals what we saw before the pandemic.
Wow. Well, that's something to look forward to. Now, let's talk briefly about COVID and how Disney, which is such a corporate giant in the state, has basically gone its own way and flouted what the governor wanted in the way of pandemic response. Now that case counts are going down and such a little bit, when people come to the parks, what kind of experience will they expect throughout the rest of this year and into 2022? What can they expect? Yep, we might have lost Seth Kuberski of Orlando Weekly, but we're speaking with him about Disney World marking 50 years in Orlando. They first opened their doors on October 1st, 1971. The story goes that Walt Disney made an offer secretly on swampland, basically wetland in central Florida. We had also read accounts that he had tried a couple of other places around the state to set up this park, including the Panhandle, and yes, the urban legend goes, even Jacksonville. There's an urban legend that I've heard for years in Jacksonville, Florida, that Disney offered a bank owner here a dollar for a bunch of wetlands in what is now TPC Sawgrass, the big golf course, and that this person, Ed Ball, allegedly told him, no, that seems like a bad deal. Kind of a bad decision, if that's true. I think we have Seth Kuberski back. Seth, in the short time we have you left, the perils of Zoom. When people come back to the parks, if they haven't been in a long time, tell them really quickly what kind of experience they will have in terms of masking or not, distancing or not, what the fan experience will be like.
Absolutely. Here in Florida, obviously under Governor DeSantis, the parks are right now are being fairly hands-off. Disney is one of the few places where wearing face masks is required for all guests when indoors. So whenever you're waiting in line for a ride at Disney or on a ride, they're going to ask you to wear those masks. Universal and the other theme parks have no masking requirements, and none of the parks are doing any sort of social distancing at this point, and none of them are requiring a vaccination or proof of a negative test, unlike the parks out in California.
So, yeah, so that is a difference on the East Coast as opposed to the West Coast. And so 18 more months of celebration to go, too, right, Seth?
Yeah, and there's still more to come. Hopefully, by the end of that celebration, Disney will have opened the Guardians of the Galaxy roller coaster that's going into Epcot, along with the Tron roller coaster, which is going into the Magic Kingdom. Those have both been long awaited. They should have been open by now, delayed because of the pandemic. But hopefully, by the time the big 50th anniversary wraps up, those will be ready to go.
All right, we'll look for that. And thank you so much, Seth, for hopping on with us to talk about the golden anniversary of Disney World. We appreciate it.
So sorry for disconnecting, but it's a pleasure talking to you. Hope to do it again.
No problem. We're used to it. We've had so many technical hiccups in this pandemic, connecting people remotely from all over the state, and we're going to make it work, people, every time. Thank you so much. He is Seth Kuberski, reporter at Orlando Weekly. Thank you. He's also a writer for Attractions Magazine and co-author of the Unofficial Guides series. And thank you for everyone who tweeted and called the show, which does air every Friday live all over the state. It's the Florida Roundup, and that is our show for today. It's produced by WJCT Public Media in Jacksonville and WLRN Public Media in Miami. Heather Schatz and Andrea Perdomo are producers. Catherine Hobbs is associate producer. WLRN's director of radio operations and technical director is Peter Mertz. Engineering help from Doug Peterson, Charles Michaels, and Josh Torres. Richard Ives answers the phones. Theme music by Miami jazz guitarist Aaron Libos at aaronlibos.com. I'm Melissa Ross. Have a happy Halloween, everyone, and a great weekend. Tom and I will be back next Friday at noon.